it's the United States that's doing
no,
that.
No, no, no. The United
and
States
Qatar
is giving the opposition weapons. The United States is arming the opposition, but the regime is backed by Russia.
Well, when you say opposition, how can somebody coming from outside the country be legitimately described as opposition instead of invader?
All the kids who rose up are from the outside of the country?
The ones who have taken over Aleppo and the north and are now using surface-to-air missiles are extra-nationals. They come from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. They come from Qatar. They come from Jihadi Sinai. They come from all throughout the region. And finally, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh,
hello.
Hi. Is this Night Watch?
Is this what?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Ah, you're on the radio, but we're out of time.
Oh, you're out of time.
Yeah, you got. If you got, if you could say it in three words, go.
Three words? I can't do it in three words. I could do it in 1 minute.
Not enough.
Okay, I'll have to do it.
Call me next week. Call me next week.
No problem.
Okay, we're taking epigrams at this point. 212-209-2900. Oh, actually, I shouldn't be announcing it because we're getting out of here. I want to be on time tonight. Jim Freund has a great guest in the person of Harlan Ellison in today's edition of Hour of the Wolf. You got an epigram?
Hello?
Hi, do you have an epigram?
Robert Knight, this is the Greek goddess. How are you? I know it's going to sound really fruity, but I was just thinking of a lot of things when I was listening, and I thought of a very funny tale. That was a true tale. When I was in Brooklyn looking for a gypsy cab driving job, I went.
Wait! That's a story. I asked for an epigram.
Epigram? You have to define an epigram.
Something really short. Something as short as that.
I have to do a sound bite.
Not even a sound bite. A sound nibble.
Oh dear.
you know I love
think
you, but
I flunked that.
Okay. Well, thank you for call me next week.
Next week.
Yes.
Okay, I'll hold on till next week. Take care, hon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Usually they like it to take a lot of time. And you're the last one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Your epigram?
Is this Nightwatch?
Earthwatch, Robert Knight. You have 15 seconds. 15 seconds. Go.
Hello?
Yeah, you have 15 seconds before we gotta go.
I wanted to tell you, okay. I wanted to tell you about the incident that happened in West Long Branch, 4th of July.
Okay, that's a story. Don't have time. Gotta go.
Okay.
Jim Ford's coming up.
Okay.
All right.
All right, call back next week. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Well, it has been a beautiful night tonight, and it's going to stay that way. Jim Freund will be up in a minute and a half with Hour of the Wolf. His guest is Harlan Ellison. And I really appreciate your wisdom and also great thanks to Dan Dorenberg for his insight on DAS and Trapwire and all of that. And you, the callers, the most brilliant audience in the world here at WBAI. Send me an email, Robert Knight, that's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And stay tuned and support the station.
This is comedian Barry Ribs. I hope you tune in to 99.5 WBAI out of New York City. Listener-sponsored free speech radio.
I'd like to tell the crowd a little bit about myself. Sober now, by the grace of God, 3 hours. And ladies, I'm not going to have sex with any of you after the show. It's not that I don't want to. I'm just making a prediction.
FM WBAI, and we hope you come out March 28th to see a great comedy show.
And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. So, this is another recorded edition for a few reasons, one of them being that I'm basically operating with a sore throat and doing, well, all kinds of personal stuff in my life. But overall, things ain't bad. And also, most of this program is pre-recorded because we did a very strange, unusual kind of a thing. We actually recorded the show practically as if it were a show this last weekend at the Lunacon Science Fiction Convention, which is held up in Rybrook, New York. And we had prearranged through volunteers or sacrifices or something like that, that Hildy Silverman, who's the editor of Space and Time magazine and a writer, and Charles E. Gannon, Chuck Gannon, would be the guests. And so we sat around a conference room, a small conference room, but good enough for radio, as we say, and recorded the show. There were a few people in there. We treated them as if they were phone callers. Whether or not they will be heard depends on time and the sound quality, which, after recording this, well, I'll be listening to it and cutting stuff in or out. But before we get to any of that, well, there's the obligatory pitching. And this is the no-fooling, no-nonsense obligatory pitching. You may be aware that last night, Tuesday night, WBAI was off the air for several hours. No, it wasn't the transmitter this time. It was the phone company apparently trying to bill us for various things going back to October, which would be fine except for the fact that we didn't even have service in October. You see, there was this hurricane, Sandy. Well, That's neither here nor there. I don't know the details. I don't know who the good guys or the bad guys are, but whenever you're writing fiction or something and the phone company is involved, you know, think of the movie The President's Analyst, and you know who the bad guys are. One way or the other, it is very important and very, very necessary for WBAI to be on the air, to stay on the air. In all the years that I've worked here, we have never been this close to the precipice of going off the air, not just for a night or a week because of the hurricane or anything, but virtually for good. Between the transmitter and all these back funds, we seem to actually be doing well. We seem to be raising money for this emergency transmitter fund to make the... We have made the March 15th deadline. It looks like we will be able to make the March 31st deadline of $150,000 and then the April 1st deadline of another $50,000, which means that we have made $250,000 in a very short period of time, and that is thanks to you. That is thanks to people who are actually coming through. We are putting together benefits to try to make sure that we can raise some money off the air. And a great deal of the staff are pulling together to do this. This is one of those strange bedfellows kinds of things, except we're not really strange bedfellows, given the different types of politics that we have at WBAI. Nevertheless, what we all are is WBAI, and we all have to hang together, or stick together, I should say. We don't want to hang together, we want to stick together. We want to be broadcasting together, and we want to be broadcasting to you. And in order for us to continue to do that, we need to go through this emergency thing. We are, if we make that $250,000 by April 1st, that'll be the total, and we've done pretty well toward getting there. That's only half the battle, because we also have to pay transmitter rent, $50,000 every single month. The simple fact that we have saved a lot of money moving from 120 Wall Street up to Harlem to CCNY is a good thing, but in fact, what it is saving us is about $25,000 to $28,000 a month, which on the one hand ain't chicken feed, but on the other hand, given all the expenses we have between payroll and $50,000 a month in the Empire State Building and so on and so forth, is, well, suffice it to say, we need to keep going. And for that, we have a special phone number. We have a call center number. We are outsourcing pledges being taken. And we need you to call area code 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. The other thing you can do is you can go to the website. And the website is give, then numeral 2, and WBAI.org. Give to WBAI.org. And I guess what that implies by that address is that you're not supposed to give once, but you're supposed to give twice. Give to WBAI.org. And once there, by the way, you have a couple of options. And one option is to just click on the upper left. You'll see something that says, you give to the transmitter fund. But over directly to the right of that is also a link that says, pledge in the name of your favorite show. Well, I know if it was me, my favorite show would have to be Hour of the Wolf because, well, what can one say? If the kind of programming that we do here in Hour of the Wolf, which involves literary science fiction and people reading to you, talking to you about it, and just all kinds of eclectic things. And we have some, assuming that there is a future, some exciting changes planned for the show in the future. More reviews, segments, things like that, which will involve two things. Number one, the continuance of WBAI, and number two, a returning Hour of the Wolf to its 2 hours or something like that. Clearly, WBAI is going to change in one way or another. It's either for the worse or for the better. And when we say for the worse, that means that you will not be able to tune in 99.5 FM and hear us at all. We just won't be there. We are that close to being shut off between the transmitter. And we were shut off last night by telco. And there are all kinds of things. On the other hand, we seem to be taking at least one half step backwards from that precipice. We seem to be doing well. But that means that we cannot let the momentum go down. We must keep the momentum going so that we will be out of the mire. And then looking into little things like buying a building for WBAI to move to. I cannot endorse this strongly enough. Our executive director, Summer Reese, has been talking about that. And of course, those who know are aware of the fact that my heart is sort of buried in the cornerstone of the church that we used to own, yes, own, on 62nd Street and 1st Avenue. How we lost that had a lot to do with, just for the sake of finger-pointing, with Pacifica and battles that we had with them in 1977. But it's a few years later, and right now Pacifica is our friend and also in as dire financial straits as we are. So, buying a building, it is. But first we have to get from here to there. First we have to survive in order to be able to make plans and point fingers and scream and yell at each other and smile at you and all that good stuff. So, again, please make a phone call right now. Area code 516-620-3602, or get onto your web browser. I recommend a big browser, not a little mobile device, even a tablet. It's a little hard to read. I would go using a computer, a laptop, or a big screen, and go to give numeral 2, WBAI.org. So, I will actually introduce what was happening at the convention, at this event. Wasn't overly attended because, well, gee, sometimes I think that Lunacon and WBAI are run by the same people. There was not a lot of information given out on programming, and that had to do with people's illnesses and stuff like that. And we were Saturday morning at 11 a.m. doing an Hour of the Wolf at that time of day. Oh, that's an unusual and rarefied thing. But nevertheless, we did it, and I thought it came out pretty well, or pretty good, as the case may be, and I hope that you'll think so as well. So you are about to hear now, recorded from March 16th of the year 2013 at 11 a.m. at the Lunacon Science Fiction Convention, a pre-recorded episode in front of an audience of teeming half dozen of people. An episode of Hour of the Wolf. This is Lunacon. This is the New York Science Fiction Convention. And this is Hour of the Wolf after a fashion. My name is Jim Freund. And we have set up to have two guests. They are Hildy Silverman and Charles Gannon. So I figure for like 15 minutes, I will talk to one of you. Hi. So do either of you have a friend? Well, you've got a very full day.
I do have a full day.
And ladies first.
Oh.
Okay. So, and on Shabbos yet. Anyway. Hildy.
Yes.
I have admired to have you on the program even before you became
owner, proprietor of Space and Time magazine?
Yeah, I think I go by publisher. Publisher, because I own it and I publish it and I do all the things behind the scenes that get it produced every quarter.
Yeah. And if there were such a thing, and there are such things as regular listeners to WBAI, they would know that Gordon Linsner birthed this magazine. How long ago?
About 46 years ago now, 1966, while
oh my
we were still
God.
In high school, yes.
Yeah, that's a year before I started doing this program, so.
Yes, yeah, he's been
at it. No, a year before I started volunteering at BAI.
Oh, okay.
Program began in 72.
Yeah, he was at it for a very long time.
Yeah.
First churning it out, I think, on mimeograph.
Of course.
The real basic, and went on from there, and along the way discovered a lot of really cool people and published their stories first.
Yeah, yeah. And also gave it really an interesting form, because it does the idea of poetry,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't recall other science fiction magazines, FNSF might have had a dirty limerick.
Yeah.
Or especially Asimov's. So Space and Time at this point is quarterly.
It is quarterly right now, yes. Unfortunately, I've been a little off schedule from time to time simply because of things in my own life. That's the downside of being very small press and being the single publisher, although I do have people who help me out with it and work for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, if my schedule gets fouled up, unfortunately, it has a ripple effect. But yes, quarterly. And our next issue is actually going to the printers this week and will be out for spring, which is not too far from now. So about 2 weeks it should be sent, going out to subscribers and out onto the shelves.
Who are the people that our listeners might have heard of who helped put this magazine together, he asked leadingly.
Good, and I'm so glad you asked that. I have fantastic people helping me out. My first readers, my associate editors, include Kathleen David, who is Peter David's wife, Alan Kistler, who's currently writing a compendium on Doctor Who. I mean, really great professionals. Gary Frank, who is a horror writer, successful horror writer. A lot of really great people are the associates. The main fiction editor is Gerard Horner, who is a fantastic writer in his own right. He's been doing this since Gordon's time. He's terrific.
Horner, yeah.
And the wonderful award-winning, Bram Stoker award-winning poet, Linda Addison, who is our poetry editor. You mentioned poetry earlier, who, again, has a fantastic eye for poetry, being a great poet herself. In fact, one of our poets, Geo Clark, is nominated for a Riesling this year.
Ah,
and we've had
the Riesling Award
Riesling
being
Award,
a science fiction award for space poetry.
For genre poetry,
yeah.
Right? We've had other nominees, and we get some really good folks. And let's see, Diane Weinstein, who is a wonderful art director. We call her our art goddess because she's that awesome. She gets promoted to goddess. She worked for years for Weird Tales, about, I think, 18. And now she finds us our cover artist and our interior artist. And, again, a woman with a wonderful eye, and she's gotten me some really spectacular artists.
When did she start? Because there was a
goodness.
Point.
About when I mean, I...
Yeah, about when you took...
About
yeah.
when I did, so,
because,
yes,
with all due respect for Gordon, I noticed a marked... improvement in the cover art about the time you took over.
She's been wonderful, and a lot of the attention we got when we restyled the magazine after I took over was because of the artwork that she secured, and also the layout done by Kate Freeman. Kate Freeman handles my layout. She changed the interiors for me. She added some nice elements. She really kicked it up a notch, actually about five notches. So I'm very pleased. I'm very lucky with everyone I work with who helps me out on this.
Let's, okay, as editor, aside from publisher, running, owning, and all this, what is your hands on? Are you making, you have a fiction editor, you have a poetry editor, but who's making the final purchase choices?
That would be me for fiction. Well, I would say 99% of what Gerard passes me, I simply, you know, read through and bless. There's very few instances where I'll say, nah, maybe not. But I like to read everything that comes across. I like to have that kind of creative control. Not with poetry. I do not claim any expertise in poetry, so I leave that up to Linda. And the artwork Diane and I collaborate on, but really she brings the folks in, and whoever she brings in is great. So there's very little issue there.
Yeah. You don't theme issues, speaking of.
I really have not. I've thought about it. It's
hard with a quarterly.
That's exactly right. It's very difficult with a quarterly to do it, to time it right. And I don't want to take the chance that I miss a deadline and it winds up a stale theme. So I've been trying to keep it. I just like to keep a mix going. A little fantasy, a little horror, a little science fiction, mostly blends thereof.
You're a writer.
Yes, that too.
Yeah, that's okay, I've done my job as host. Now you talk. Tell us about your fiction and other writing.
Writing things.
Yeah.
Well, I write short
I'm
stories.
I'm so articulate.
Understand,
it's true that I'm more articulate at 5 a.m. than I am at 11.
Whatever time it is, 11:30?
I'm just noticing they have a clock here, and it has no hour hand.
Oh.
I just noticed that.
Yes. Whoops.
Well,
it's 11:30 if that helps.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I write short fiction. I write all different kinds, a lot of horror, and it's all been published in anthologies, various anthologies, the latest of which I have two stories out in two anthologies.
Hold it up for the audience to see.
Audience? I've got
yes, especially that audience member over there, Mr. Rodriguez, who loves looking at book covers.
There you go. I've got Apocalypse 13.
My listeners know who I'm talking about.
Oh, good.
Yes.
So we don't. It doesn't seem like we're teasing anyone.
When I go on the air and I say, "Can we take listener calls now?" That means him.
Okay. I have a story in Apocalypse 13 called Black Market Magic, and Apocalypse 13 is a collection of stories all dealing with the end of days.
Is that the 13th issue, or is it just that the number
just chose
is cool?
They did a series of books that all have 13 in them. Collections are all 13. There's a Far Futures 13, I think, premiering this weekend. But my other story is Tales from the Sea Mermaids 13, and I have a story in there called The $6 Million Mermaid.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, that's a fun one. That's a fun one. That's gotten some good attention, so... I've also written short stories for anthologies for Esther Friesner,
mm-hmm.
Her books through Bayon's Techno Books.
I see a Bayon theme coming.
Yes, I have that little Bayon connection.
The Bayon of our lives. and I worked for Jim Bayon.
So you could say that.
I worked at Galaxy.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
I worked at Galaxy magazine when Jim Bayon was editor. I was first reader. How long have you been writing?
I
didn't say publishing.
Writing?
No,
just
I
writing?
Actually asked about writing, yeah.
Okay, since I was six.
Okay.
Yes. I've been writing fairly obsessively since first grade. Just, you know, like a lot of kids who went into this, writing and putting it in a drawer and writing it, showing it to mom and writing it for school and scaring the teachers and that kind of thing. So it was a while before I actually started trying to get published professionally, but I've been writing.
How much of a while?
I did not submit something for publication until I was in my, mid to late 30s.
Till last year.
I love you. You're such a good person. we're going back a lot more than that, more like 10 years ago.
I would not have guessed. But having said that, how long from first submission to first publication?
It was not a bad cycle. I first submitted to a contest that was going on with John Ordover. John Ordover had started up a press, and he was doing an anthology.
This was Phobos?
Yes, Phobos Books, that's right. And I sent, you know, I'm one of the many people who sent stories in for, it was a themed anthology.
I did not know that we had... that he had. I used John's gallery for our
meetings. Right, Soho Gallery, yes.
Absolutely.
Well, so, yes, exactly. Great place, too.
And I haven't had John on the show since 2 weeks ago. Well, he was the second guest I had in our new, I won't call them facilities. Our new faculties. It's in a college, yes. In our new faculties.
Your dorm.
Which I've been, well, yes! That's it! Thank
You're
you! I think you've just named our studios!
There you go.
The dorm.
The dorm.
Yeah, because it's, and a pretty blank poor one it is.
Aww,
too.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, that's, I'm trying to remember the seven words, you see. And in the master control room, I would have a list in front of me of bleep, 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 mother bleep, and then bleep bleeper. And so I would usually look at the list, and I would say, the number one, you say.
And that's how I get.
Yeah, and actually, I should do that. Just put on the website.
Yes.
You know what the seven words are, and then if you want to know what curse word I just used, go to the website.
So it's Hour of the Wolf Mad Libs. Just plug in.
Oh, what a wonderful idea!
I'll sign the contract.
Yeah, absolutely.
Me, you know, we'll work out the terms.
Roger,
you can take that.
What's his name? He just died. The man who created Mad Libs.
Oh, yeah?
He died about 6 weeks ago. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. He was not young, but nevertheless.
Yes.
And he did a lot of other interesting things. But,
yeah.
This is me, Digression Radio. So, we said basically dark fantasy, but there's a variety of writing.
Yes.
But you know what? Let us now talk to Chuck for a while, and then we'll all panelize or something along those lines.
Come back together.
Charles Gannon, how had you? What is your you are Chuck informally, but your byline?
It's Charles E. Gannon, which I do largely because I published a lot. Nonfiction, academic, and popular as well. And somebody said to me, and I think they're probably right, everything you do is part of your career. And these days, particularly given what a search engine does, you might as well keep it under one name. So I thought about that. If I found myself going into other fields that are distinct enough, I would probably, and have already thought about if you will, a pen name for a different genre, comprised out of a fusion of my children's name. That's actually, for instance, if I was to go into writing techno thrillers that are non-genre, you would probably not want to go in with the same name, because the stores will tend to say, how many books can I carry by this guy? And you would think, well, they would be able to sift, but they don't.
Oh, is that one of the reasons?
They don't sift it out. They don't sort it out. Yeah, because. For instance, so if I had Charles E. Gannon, Fire with Fire, and then I'm in a collaboration as well, and then I happen to have, let's say, a techno thriller, they're going to say, that's too much. You know, this guy, I don't know that this guy can carry all that weight. And they might be right, but the bottom line is, if I change my name for the distinctive genre, let's say the techno thriller, then supposedly that doesn't get
picked
up.
But then you could actually still just, then you could become like Chuck Gannon. Or, I mean, Ian Banks versus Ian M. Banks.
Right.
Not a big stretch.
But I would become Kyle Connors.
Ooh.
Okay, that is a very Terminator feel to it.
It does, I guess Connors, yeah. But one of my son's names is Kyle, and the other was Connor.
Oh, my God. I mean, isn't Kyle the soldier who...
Yes, you're right.
Yes.
Oh, my word.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'm not...
Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
You did. Don't tell your children this.
No, it's too good.
They would be Schwarzenegging all over the house if you did that. Yes.
They'd be back.
Yes. That would be could be a scary thing.
Yes.
Schwarzenegging all over the place.
Indeed.
It's a new verb. Somebody could be Stalloning, somebody could be Schwarzenegging. Yeah.
How would you... I'm sorry. I am certainly a sorry figure. How would you describe your fiction overall? You have an academic background, but you know your science. I believe I moderated a panel, was it Lunacon last year?
Yes.
That you were on where the subject was so over my number three-ing head that I had I was suffering to ask questions.
I'm sorry.
It had to do with space agency accomplishments, and it really was about rocket science.
Well, yeah,
I did finish the eighth grade. I did not finish the ninth.
The interesting thing about a panel like that is that folks are hearing things that they won't find in my fiction. I think hopefully what you feel is the groundedness of it, that the rigor is there underneath. But I certainly don't feel that sort of material is, that's not what I put in the pages, because I think it can be distancing. It takes a lot of time. I think it's wonderful that we live in the age of the website, because for those who are interested, you can go and find it. You can go and find the stuff that's underneath it, and that's part of what I do with my webpage.
Well, and we have to each, by the way, from each of you, listeners, get your pencils sharpened and all that, because we're going to be, or your virtual pencils, because we'll be giving out website addresses and things like that in a while. How overall, before we get back to such things as real life and what you do, how would you describe most of your fiction?
Most of my fiction would fall into the category of hard science fiction.
Now, hard science fiction for listeners meaning stuff that involves tech, stuff that is feasible.
Let's put it like this. If you're going to break the rules as we know them to be today, and that is, I would say we have to remember that laws are generally just extremely reliable hypotheses, that if you're going to break some of the current laws understood of physics or believed to be understood of physics, you need to provide a reasonable explanation. And that explanation has to take into account what I would call first and second order objections based on other observed phenomena. So if you're going to break the light speed limit, however you're going to do it, you better give long and hard thought to just how you're going to do it.
After all, countering Einstein. So,
well, you're countering Einstein if you go faster than light. But if you go...
yes.
But you can...
But you said break the light speed.
Right.
Not?
Yes, okay. I did. And that's...
But there are other ways to break it than going faster.
That's actually for the listeners, because I figured if I said supraluminal travel, which is actually really what I'm talking about.
I took a pill like that.
Yes. But. And that was in the 60s, and you just woke up 20 minutes ago, right? Yeah. So, at any rate...
No, I am in the 60s, and I'm watching myself now.
There you go. Okay. You and Timothy Leary. But at any rate, so hard science fiction for me is, if I'm going to do something like that, I have an explanation, and I'll go into the physics and even the economy of it, how you would be able to support it over a period of time. But that largely does not show up in the fiction. I think Heinlein was a real master at, he will refer to things the way we would refer to our technology. You know, he doesn't explain what a television is. He just refers to the television, and you acquire a knowledge of what the device does. And from the peripheral components of the world, you understand that, yeah, it fits in, it's believable. I go with that. I don't need to have it all broken out for me. And that's a rule I try to bear in mind when I do the fiction.
Yeah.
So it's hard science fiction, but I would not call it tech-obsessed in the body of the fiction itself.
Yeah.
Because my, you know...
And hard science fiction doesn't mean that it isn't easy reading and thoroughly entertaining.
Right.
Which is certainly something that Heinlein and Ted Sturgeon...
Absolutely.
And Golden Era writers proved.
Repeatedly. And in that way, I'm very much... not merely in their debt. I'm a lesser offspring, I would like to think, of that pantheon of folks who started us in the hard science fiction genre.
I don't know about lesser offspring, say next evolutionary.
I will leave it for you and others to say that, not myself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were breaking new ground, and let's face it, they were writing pulp.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that must be recognized.
Yes. Yes.
And when Heinlein got serious is when Heinlein got bad. So, I think there's a lot of truth to what I just said there.
Absolutely. One of the things that I also try to bring in is some of the sensibilities from other fields of literature. People will not know it, but there is a line heavily influenced by a line from Faulkner's As I Lay Dying in here, and it's quite purposeful, and I'm tapping fire with fire. That doesn't mean you're going to...
You're also tapping near the mics.
Yes. Okay. True enough. And it's a little grace note, and it doesn't impede the reading, and just because you don't like Faulkner, you won't know it's Faulkner. People have read it who hate Faulkner, and they don't even see it, right? There you go. But the thing is...
You know what I like about Faulkner? That Lee Brackett wrote his movies. Big Sleep,
mm-hmm.
by William Faulkner, right. And Lee Brackett.
Yeah, yes, right.
The commonly accepted... Jules Furthman.
Yeah.
And the commonly accepted story behind that is Faulkner would be, sitting down with his... face in the soup, and she would lift his head and say, "How's that, Bill?" The head back then. In truth, I did read something from Jules Furthman saying Faulkner wasn't even there.
Yeah.
So,
talk about dialing it in. But at any rate, I find that many authors, and Faulkner's a kind of interesting example because he's playing with the medium. And he's pushing it to the limit and frequently beyond. And I think it's comfort with limits, and also the fact that when you experiment at the edge, you fail a lot. I don't think that necessarily folks in the Academy are willing to say that about one of their canonized gods, but I'm very much a person who I'd like to think of myself as eclectic. When I have found other writers who do things well, no matter where I find them, I say, okay, how did they do that? One of the things about Faulkner, which is frequently lost, is when he writes action, it is extremely sparse and it's extremely clean. And you wouldn't think that when you read the long discursive passages on the swirling dust motes in the sunlit room, which takes up literally about a page and a half I can't even remember which one of them right now. But this is the sort of thing that finds its way into my work, and I don't prefer one style over another. I see it all as different. They're all different colors for me to put on my palette and use them at need when mm-hmm. I turn toward my own canvas.
When did you start writing? And again, not selling, writing.
Right. I understand that. Well, I would hope not selling, because I don't care how precocious you are. If you're writing it for and selling it, there's something wrong with the publishing industry, I think, unless it's a memoir of some sort.
Although I just audio edited a story by a 19-year-old that blew me away for Lightspeed Magazine, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, I'm blanking on his name, but wow.
Right.
So, yeah, there are precocious...
Absolutely. Well, right.
Well, 1904.
Yes, yeah. So my history as a writer...
Oh, and he's been writing for 5 years. He's been self-publishing for 5 years.
Wow.
So
my history as a writer basically works this way, and it also explains why I'm a science fiction writer, I think. I was 4, I loved paleontology, and I wanted to write about it. At 7, I loved zoology, and I wanted to write about it. And I wanted to become a zoologist and wanted to become a paleontologist. Then at 8, I shifted quickly into astronaut. I discovered how dangerous that was and wanted to become, therefore, an astronomer at age 7 and write about it. And sometime around age 12, and I'd been writing all this time, I realized what I really want to do is write about all sorts of cool things that I don't want to spend a huge amount of time with quantitative stuff that is, for me, fairly dull, so I get to have a couple of cool moments every year. Whereas if I write about it and I know, and if I have a solid layman's understanding of it, I get to actually play in all these fields virtually for the rest of my life. So that was both my source as a writer and my source, if you will, of science fiction, because where else do you get to play with all these things and have them admixed at the same time?
Yeah. I don't know. I've never written science fiction or anything. I just talk about it. But, you know, I went with the same route. When I was four, I was throwing bones around the house, and there's the paleontology.
Right.
Then I wanted to be an astronaut.
Okay.
So there was the astronomy, and the zoology was like, it's like, can I have that elephant? So I was, anyway.
Exactly the same.
So I went through exactly the same thing, but I just talk about it instead. So that's the net result of all of that. But enough about you. What about me? No. You teach.
I taught.
You taught.
Last time I was in the classroom was 2007, which was when I made the jump to full time writing. I'd had actually...
That's a big jump. That's
it is a huge
steep
jump.
Steep cliff.
It is. It's great when you have a very well-employed wife as well. I was living up in... I still have actually my credential as a distinguished professor of English at St. Bonaventure University, and that was fun. But I'd done that, and actually the teaching was, as much as I loved it, was really a means of trying to support a writing career, because as somebody once told me when I was about 19, they said, "Oh, you want to be a writer? Well, unless you're one of the Stephen Kings of the world, you've got three choices fundamentally. The first one was you could become a person of the cloth and write in your free time." And I was temperamentally unsuited to that, and my testosterone told me I was temperamentally unsuited.
I have a great enthusiasm for people of the cloth, because walking around naked is horrible.
There you go. There you go. Sackcloth in this case.
You're going to use that one, aren't you, David? I thought so.
And light on the ashes. Sackcloth and light on the ashes. And the second one was to be kept by a wealthy significant other, for which I was more suited in certain regards, but again, temperament, I probably would want more of my own life than that. And third was to be an academic, particularly at the college level, because the fiction was you would have those summers. Well, the problem is, the good news was I was pretty successful as an academic. The bad news was I was pretty successful as an academic, which means people come and say, "Will you do this? Will you do that? Will you do the other things?" By the time I'd been at the St. Bonaventure for 3 years, I was put in charge of the graduate program. I grew up by 400% in about 18 months to 2 years, and the bottom line was more, more, more. Well, more, more, more turns into less, less, less time, and you go from one kid to two kids to four kids, and you know, so the cliff was steep, but it was the only, that Kierkegaardian leap of faith, in this case having to do more with words than deity, was probably the only way to make the transition. Because I'd been in the career before and had actually had a number of novels under contract, and it had all gone away.
Those alternate universes in which they didn't go away are interesting.
They would be. They would, because it happened when I was 31, and I was working. I was doing most of my writing in the game industry.
So I can do it again. Last year. Just using the same line I used.
Thanks. Sorry, slow on the uptake. But at 31, I was multiply contracted with Game Design Workshop, which has since folded. And they had me doing two tie-in novels for their game systems. I was contracted for that. And there was going to be another novel coming out of the War World series, which was packaged by Jerry Purnell and largely John Carr. And that anthology stopped dead, like almost all the other Jerry Purnell anthologies, about which thereby must hang the tale. But I had three novels under contract.
I have a number two eating grin on my face that the listeners do not get to appreciate. But anyway.
So I had been working television. 75% of my income was coming from television. So when I got this opportunity to do three novels, I went in and I said, "Can I cut back?" And they said, "We're just calling to ask you," because I was full-time freelance. They wanted to make me full-time. I said, "I can't do that." They said, "There's the door." So then all three novels went south. Had nothing to do with me. It was corporate shifts up and down the line.
Wow.
And that was a big shock. I fell back on the academics. That is what put me in that career, but I didn't give up, and I published occasionally in Analog and other places, and have made as rapid and hopefully successful a return as possible.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM, or as some people say, WBAI New York. And you are listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And you are listening to a pre-recorded episode of Hour of the Wolf, the majority of which was recorded this past Saturday morning at the Lunacon Science Fiction Convention. And most Hour of the Wolves, when we say last Saturday morning, we used to mean 5 a.m. This is more like 11 a.m. And my guests are Hildy Silverman and Charles E. Gannon, as the case may be. And we're taking this opportunity to interrupt and tell you that we are in the middle of a fundraising drive because, you know what, from now on, we're in the middle of a fundraising drive, or at least until we do approximately another $300,000. This goes to the current transmitter emergency that we're dealing with, plus seeing our way through basically the transmitter rent through August. It comes about $50,000 a month, and little things like the payroll. No, I'm not on it. I'm unpaid staff. But there are people that are needed to be paid in order to keep WBAI operating. And the other basic expenses, including, you know, settling with our creditors and then moving along. No doubt there will be a capital fundraising drive after this to try to move us to a new place. But right now we have people standing by at area code 516-620-3602 to take your pledge, to take your call, to support listener-sponsored WBAI. And this is a call center. This is not like, you know, a bunch of volunteers that we used to have standing by, and that saddens me. I started at WBAI as a phone volunteer in, Lord help me, May of 1967 was the first time that I did that. So now, for at least right now, until we are back on our feet, we have to outsource all this stuff because we're sort of in exile. We're in so many places. So give that call center a call. That's what they are centered for. Area code 516-620-3602. And you can also go to the website, give2wbai.org. That's two, the number two, and everything else is a word. Give blank WBAI, and the blank is the number two. And once there, click on Give to the Transmitter Fund or click on Give in the name of your favorite program, which is, of course, Hour of the Wolf. And now we return you through the Wayback Machine to last Saturday morning at, probably almost noon by now, given the recording, to Charles E. Gannon and Hildy Silverman at Lunacon.
And speaking of novels, yes. Chuck, yeah. Well, I understand that you have a novel out.
I have. Well, the novel that's out, the one that I will not tap, which is on the table in front of me, which is called Fire with Fire, comes out in about 2 weeks, April 2. The most recent novel that's out, which is a collaboration with Eric Flint in the 1632 series, mm-hmm. called The Papal Stakes, which Bill is waving around in the back.
Does Bill have a last
Friedman,
name?
I believe.
Correct. Bill Friedman.
Yes. Hi, Bill Friedman. Yet another author. Come to play.
Somebody from Long Island. They don't, you know.
That novel went Wall Street Journal bestseller 2 weeks in October. So that was nice.
Yeah.
And while it's not New York Times, I want to give a shout out to the Wall Street Journal because they still use BookScan. And BookScan still counts books instead of other places, which just count, strangely enough, press the button on the cover, go to the website, and it counts, I think, as one-third of a purchase, which, having a background in television and time buying, I can tell you what I think of those numbers. So that's a nice lead into a series start with Bane, the first book in the series. The series title is Tales of the 22nd Century. The first
now we should explain that since we've invoked the name, that Jim Bain is not just a person.
Oh no,
but a publishing company.
Absolutely, Jim Bain gave his name to an imprint, which John Clute, sitting next to me at World Fantasy this past year, dubbed the last of the great mass market publishers. I'm not sure if that's accurate, but it was.
I'm not sure it's wrong either.
And hence my sharing it right now.
I mean, other ones continued to survive, Dahl
right.
Books and all
right.
that, but I cannot name another mass market publisher that made it to market after Bain Books did.
Right.
And he did so in a very innovative
yes,
fashion.
Yes.
I believe that I think it can be fairly said that he helped innovate the e-book.
Oh, absolutely. And the e-library, which has been all but free for pennies, is
largely
only
Eric
recently
Flint's doing also, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and Eric and Bain are obviously very, very closely linked. But they just recently, as a matter of fact, they're still keeping some of the e-library available, but the difficulty is, in order for them to be carried with Amazon and a variety of other markets, they had to come to some sort of agreement that they weren't selling a book for pennies that, of course, Amazon wanted to sell for a whole lot more. But they have definitely been and continue to be groundbreakers in terms of electronic publishing.
Yeah.
So this book is with
and
them.
People can still for a while go to what's the URL for the free books at Bain?
Wish I could tell you. I don't know it off the top of my
head.
Well,
I'll find it and insert it into this broadcast. Tell us a little about what Fire with Fire actually is going to say, Tracy.
I will read from the copy on the back.
Oh,
how about that?
Sheet.
Okay. 2105 September. Intelligence analyst Kane Riordan uncovers a conspiracy on Earth's moon, a history-making clandestine project, and ends up involuntarily cryocelled for his troubles. 12 years later, Riordan awakens to a changed world. Humanity has achieved faster than light travel and is pioneering nearby star systems. And now Riordan is compelled to become an inadvertent agent of conspiracy himself. Riordan's mission: travel to a newly settled world and investigate whether a primitive local species was once sentient, enough so to have built a lost civilization. There's a second paragraph, but we don't need to.
Yeah, but it's a nice premise, because you were talking about those different disciplines earlier, and that they all somehow turn up in Fire with Fire, don't
Absolutely.
They?
Archaeology shows up as well, and also the difference in understanding how different, because we discovered that there's actually an accord of very quiet exosapient races, which have not lost certain technologies over time, and how different species achieve the same effect through different technical methods is one of the things that I also have some fun with here.
Fire with Fire will have follow-up.
Fire with Fire, the two follow-ups have already been purchased. The second one is already in first draft. It is called Trial by Fire. And to give people a sort of, and I'll work outside the genre, because it seems to me your listeners are drawn from a very wide well indeed.
One would hope.
Yes.
Being broadcast radio, we're not just going
right
to the science fiction reader.
So if Fire with Fire is something of a mix. Somebody has described it as 3 Days of the Condor meets The Winds of War, because the Winds of War being essentially the prelude. If you know the Hermann Weyl series, the war has really not started.
But, I knew the miniseries.
Right,
but
right. There you go.
One shouldn't boast about that.
And
very good.
How tactfully said. Yes, I'm going to leave it right there. I can't. How execrable was that? At any rate, not so tactfully said. But the second book is a little bit more like The Longest
Day. I like Robert Mitchum, okay?
Yes, right, right. And he played himself wonderfully. But the second book... but the second book, Trial by Fire, is now imagine The Longest Day meets Tora, Tora, Tora. Things do break wide open. And Fire with Fire is a very the full saying, of course, as everybody knows, is sometimes you have to fight fire with fire, and that becomes quite literal in a speciate sense in this novel, and that's all I'm going to say about it.
Okay, that's intriguing. So you have your very long elevator pitch.
Oh, I don't. I can't do an elevator pitch.
That was a Sears Tower elevator pitch.
Yes, right. Up and down both, I think.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so let's open this up, because in some ways, with both Hilde Silverman and Charles E. Gannon, it doesn't seem obvious that pairing offhand, and yet you both have connections to Bain Books. Hilde has published one of your stories, which is not exactly hard SF, is it?
Nope.
What story is that? Why don't you talk about Chuck for a second?
I'll talk about. Well, I also got to throw in just a quick little anecdote.
Then you get to talk about
a quick little anecdote that shows yet another connection that we found between us. Chuck mentioned being at St. Bonaventure. Well, back at Brandeis, one of my closest friends, Cheryl Gelfand, her father was a professor at St. Bonaventure and knew Chuck. So we found that out after we had met each other. It was just this very weird coincidence that we had this connection. And I told Cheryl about you, and she's like, "Oh, Chuck, how is he?" So he was very excited to hear that I knew you. So I'm going to be perfectly honest. I'm blanking on the actual title. All I remember is
Busy. Cyber Keats Story.
Cyber Keats Story is the story I bought. And it is a very moving and emotional story. There is, of course, a science fiction element. In Cyber Keat, you can figure that out. I don't want to give anything away. I'm just going to say that it was. I found it a very touching story. And one of the things I gauge when I'm deciding that I'm going to buy something, I take a lot of the stories with me to Starbucks. And if I'm distracted by the people ordering, I'm distracted by the people walking by or the conversation next to me, I know it's not that intriguing a story. Or if I decide, oh, well, time to go halfway through, probably not one I'm going to buy. I sat down with Chuck's, and all of a sudden, whoops, I had blown past the time I was supposed to leave to get to work. I read it end to end. I wasn't distracted by a thing, and it's a really, really good story. It's got to be coming out in our summer issue 119. So people should look for that. It's really, and I think, and Chuck can confirm, a little bit of a departure from what you usually write.
Yes. Not that I necessarily want it to be, but it's sometimes a difficult sell, and I don't exactly know why that is. Probably it's significant that it's one of my shorter pieces as well. I think it is harder to sustain certain delicate human emotions than it is the sort of, when you're working in intrigue and you're working in action and you're working in thrillers, you got the pot boiling all the time, and you can talk about all sorts of intellectual things, and you can have an emotional moment, and but you've got this constant tension line that's running and carries through. I find it, and this is some of the wonderful folks in the field who've managed to just create beautiful passages and maintain delicate emotional responses are people I so admire, and I can't. I think it's Jack Vance comes to mind with his ability to do that. You can read people ordering a cup of coffee in a different time space stream in Jack Vance, and you'll read it for
well. That's
an
where
hour.
Hildy is doing the reading is ordering a cup of coffee.
Exactly, so. Right.
Or a tall soy and a water chime.
So we have to get Starbucks to do a Vance blend.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
And Jack Vance can be very bitter, just like Starbucks coffee. But
time space Java. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, so that's some of the confluences that exist between the both of you. I'm trying to figure out, the questions that will actually continue that theme of confluence. We've got from you, why SF? Hilde, why SF?
Why SF?
Yeah, three letters.
Yes. Well, for me, it's broader. I'd say it's more.
And I use, by the way, the Damon Knight definition of science fiction,
right.
Which I have to
nice
explain to listeners,
okay.
Is science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Okay.
Back in 3 minutes. Okay.
Got it. Why? Well, I guess because it's the thing that pulled me out of my real world, which I was not enjoying terribly much as a teenager, as many teenagers do not.
I've noticed that.
Yes. I've always enjoyed the fantastic. I've enjoyed the speculative. I started out, my first interests were in very hard SF books. I first read Ben Bova, Isaac Asimov, and, you know, that was my entree. And then moving forward, I one day picked up Richard Matheson's collections of short stories, and I was riveted. I loved them, and I said, ooh, more like this, and went on and expanded my horizons from there. So all of it, I mean, everything, there's elements in the speculative that I just find very engaging. Not to say I don't read other things. Like I said, I read Wook's Winds of War and War of Remembrance. I enjoyed those. I do read some outside the genre. But my love is really there.
Yeah, when I started, I was such a fanboy. That is, why would I read anything outside of the genre? And then I sort of realized that I was reading outside the genre, and simply by using that Damon Knight definition, trying to justify it all.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, Shakespeare, yeah, Midsummer Night's Dream, well, that's genre. So, and, yeah, well, that Julius Caesar stuff, well, I like that, too.
It's alternate history, you know?
Yeah, well, it is.
You can pull it in,
yeah. I mean,
yes.
all of Shakespeare's history is alternate history, you know.
So it still works.
You know, I'm right now discovering the Hollow Crown, and as all we know, Richard III is alternate history,
yes.
Because it didn't happen that way, and we know now that actually he was killed by being buried in a parking lot. So
yes, that's terrible.
Yes. So you know that.
Poor Richard.
You know, that, and you know where is he going to find a horse in a parking lot? Anyway,
they are.
And this also brings up another question, which is good for the both of you, and something Chuck that you brought up earlier. The short form. This is my favorite question. When I was in the days when chats were the big things online for Omni Magazine and later for whatever the name of Ellen Dadlow's first online magazine was.
The first one.
Something Horizon.
Yeah, I don't know.
Strange?
No, it was a different one.
It was a different Horizon.
Event Horizon?
Yes.
Event Horizon.
Event Horizon,
yes.
Absolutely. I was alternating as a chat host, and I would ask this same question every week, and I often do this on the air, and one of these days I'm going to annoy the hell out of her. And I'm still proud of it, and I'm going to ask it again. And the reason I want to ask it almost every time, and with the two of you, is because one of these days, if I ever go through my archives, I will find where I ask that question. And edit all these different people together, giving the answer. And the question is preferences, advantages and disadvantages of the long form versus the short form. And I'll preface that by saying, in an anthology, the title of which I don't remember, James Gunn was the editor of that anthology, and he wrote this forward about short fiction that I have treasured through the years, about how a good short story is a polished gem and how hard it is to craft that. And not that novels aren't difficult, but they allow you elbow room. You can travel from one place to another. You can throw in a Tom Bombadil, which is practically a universe in and of itself, but not necessarily part of the big tale you are telling. But the short story, you don't do that. The short story, a single change of a word can change the nature. Hilda, you have not written a novel?
I actually have.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, it hasn't been published yet. Hopefully it will be at some point. I have written two, one of which I've set aside for now, but the other is complete, and actually I have an editor who's working with me on polishing it up for submission. So I actually have the experience of writing it.
On polishing it up.
Yes.
That is cool.
I'm a firm believer that every writer should get an independent editor to go over their work before they submit.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So yes, not the editor's necessarily going to buy it.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Not an acquiring editor, an actual copy edit. Person who's going to copy edit and give feedback and things like that.
Yeah, why not?
Even though I do both, you can't do it for yourself. Do your best work.
So how is writing, let me turn to Chuck and then to you, how is writing the short form different for you than the long form?
Massively different. The part of it probably has to do with the way I write. I will have word counts. If I get a 9-hour work day in and I do not have the interruptions of being Dr. Dad, my biggest problem is that, for instance, at a 4-hour interval, I'll suddenly look up and say, wow, I really have to go to the bathroom. To say that I'm in an immersive state when I write is an understatement, and that allows me to generate a lot of words, and I keep 90% of those words. So I'll have days where my raw production is 7,000 or 8,000 words.
Yow.
Yeah, and that probably more average about 6 or 5. But you can't do that with a short story. And it's because the short story is that gem. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't try to bring the same care to a novel, but a novel starts as a different premise, and it serves a different purpose. In a short story, particularly, let's say, 5,000 words or under, you can only touch the tips of the most important icebergs in order to give a sense of the world. And I think, for instance, in a moment, and I write action with this notion in mind as well. You can look at, for instance, a Rembrandt painting of a horse. The detail, it's extraordinarily detailed, and it's wonderful, and it's photorealistic. But then you take a look at, for instance, a Japanese ink painting of it, 16 lines. And one of the things you get is maybe not the detail, but it captures the motion, and it captures the essence of horse, if you will. 16 strokes. And I think of a short story that way, and I'll fuse that with something that, give a shout out here to a friend of mine in this business, a friend of mine outside of this business, hell of a nice guy and a neighbor, Bud Sparhawk, who is an absolute master of the short form, in my opinion.
He is, and yes, a very nice guy.
Great. Yeah, and he likes to say that a short story is essentially like telling the joke, is like telling a joke. Not that it's funny, but that a joke only remains funny if you pare it down to its bare essentials, no more and no less.
Thank you. Shaggy dogs need not apply.
Exactly. So to me, to get back to how that interfaces with my writing style, the money today is in novels. It probably has been for a long time, but more so now than ever before.
Oh, please. I was interviewed last week, Ken Liu. Mm-hmm. And Ken Liu with, three nominated three out of four Nebula categories and won all the short story awards last year on Paper Menagerie, which won the Hugo, the Nebula, the World Fantasy, and so forth, made $75 on that story.
Yeah.
So
and so when I have to sit down and write a short story, one of the things
that's almost a meal.
Yeah, one of the things I have to ask myself is, because of the amount of time and craft that goes into it, and like I say, I'll put the same time and craft into a novel, but I know at the end of the day that's producing something different. And I'm actually more interested in saying the sort of things you can say and the discourse you can enter into with your audience through a novel than I am with a short story most of the time. But then we talk, just turning briefly to this story that I'm fortunate enough for Hildy to have kindly consented to say, yeah, we'll give it a shot. A Cyberkeet story, I couldn't have done that as a novel. I can't do it as a novel because the subject matter doesn't want to be that long, and it needs to be literally a grace note. It's a story that has a lot of literally poetry in it. And when I say literally poetry, for instance, E.E. Cummings cited in it and a number of others. So that's the sort of thing. But I knew sitting down writing a story like that, I'm taking a hit in the sense of I am giving up money Literally, I'm giving up money in order to do this because the time it takes to think about every last word you're using and not worth it, how many times you go through an edit. I mean, it started as something like 6,300 words. I think it's now something like 42, something like that.
Yeah.
Now, you kill that many words in a novel at a blink. The scene doesn't work. Out it goes.
Uh-huh.
With a short story, chopping it from 62 to 42, there's a lot of sweat and red ink involved.
There's a word for that kind of thinking. Art.
Yeah.
But... and yes, you one bleeds for it. Yeah, it's very true. But just reminds me of a story with a writer friend of mine, John Anderson, who was on Hour of the Wolf, and we actually had this conversation. He had published two really good novels, Gray and... I'm blanking right now on the name of the other novel. And... I asked him about short stories, and he said, it's never even really occurred to me. And then later on, he was talking about how many false starts that he made on his novels. And he said, I wrote 15,000 words of this, and then I just threw it away. And I said, you threw it away? You didn't put it in a trunk? And he was thinking, you mean like a trunk story? I said, yes. And... about 4 months later, I got an excited email saying, I sold a short story on one of the things I threw away. Very proud of myself.
Of course.
And now he's actually working on getting that other craft, the short story craft. Hildy, how are, both as an editor and a writer, the long form and the short form for you?
Well, I think Chuck covered a lot of it. And he's absolutely right. It's a very different mindset. There's a lot more real estate, obviously, with a novel. You can digress into beautiful descriptions of the motes of dust in the light and keep things going, assuming you write that well. If you do that in a short story, you're done. I mean, you don't have time to go into that kind of detail. Like, some very, very few writers can craft a story with that detail and not stop it cold. Or keep it from going to 10,000, 15,000 words, which is kind of, you're into novella, novelettes,
territory. And note, by the way, I said short form versus long form. I did not specify word counts.
Right.
I'm very vague about these things very much on purpose.
Yes, yeah, you have a little bit, I mean, depending on how short you're short for, I'm thinking short stories, because that's what I'm used to, publishing and writing. So yes, you do have to, you use that old adage, kill your darlings. The way I handle it, I normally write however long the story wants to be. And it's usually too long. I'm one of these people who, I also write a lot, and I write very quickly. I'm a very fast typist. I will write obsessively. So it quickly expands. And then I hack and slash it into whatever word count I've been told I have to get to.
Yeah,
I find it easier that way, because if I turn on my editor brain while the writer is writing, I can't get things done. I'm too busy criticizing every word, and it stops me right in my tracks. So I turn off the editor, I just write. I let it come out, however long it's going to be, and then I hack and slash, and I keep an older version in case I ever want to do something more with it, maybe expand it to full length, and I go from there. So that is my method. It is tough, you know, and working with writers from the other side, there are some who just are amazing at it. It's like Chuck was saying about the horse with the 16 strokes. They can put that together. They get the emotion across. They get the characterization across. They get the story across. I'm thinking right off the top of my head, Jack Ketchum, Dallas, is fabulous.
Dallas Taylor.
Jack's real name. I'm blanking on his last name.
Yeah, I'm blanking on it too.
Mayor. Dallas.
That's
Mayor.
Okay, yeah. Because when you say Jack Ketchum,
Dallas.
We just have to explain to listeners that he's not from Texas.
Right, no. That's who he really is. But he is a master of that. He can create full characters, a full cast of characters who are fully realized, and give them a story and give them a life. in such a small amount of real estate.
He manages to churn my stomach in 3,000 words.
Yes.
He's
brilliant. He's simply brilliant at it.
And he's a good reader. I listen to him and I'm like,
yay. Yeah, he's great.
Dark is one thing. His kind of horror, that visceral, is like...
Grabs you and won't let you go, yes.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, others, like I mentioned Matheson, who pulled me in. Richard Matheson.
Matheson is
Cracked
one of
the
my
jewels.
Favorites.
His stories were so complete and such... And there's not a wasted word.
Yeah. You know? And he comes from the era, the digest era of the Rod Serling era of the perfectly crafted...
When you
little.
Could make money as a short fiction writer. There was a time where people made their living at it. You know, ask Tom Purdom sometime. I mean, that was, and still is to a degree, his life was writing short stories. You could live off of that. It's a shame that, unfortunately, things have changed and it's a lot more difficult.
And some of those writers who were the masters of the short story wrote awful novels.
Yes.
Frederick Brown comes to mind.
Yes, some people cannot do both.
He wrote some good novels, but I loved What Mad Universe, but some of his novels were, they're often fix-ups. They were financial necessities, and I did not care for them.
Yeah.
And
some people can't write short, and some people can't write long. There's a lot of short fiction writers who, when they try to expand to a full-length novel, they just don't know what needs to be in there to keep the story going yet come to novel length.
Yeah. And then there are some people who can pull off a tour de force, which is take a short story and make it a good fix-up. So The Fireman by Ray Bradbury becomes Fahrenheit 451. Was it The Guardian becomes Childhood's End? What is the original novella there? And Larry Niven wrote one, now I don't remember the name of either the short story, the novella, or the novel that it was turned into, but about a corpsicle who's brought back to life in a fascist state so he can be a pilot and somehow manages to escape. And the end of the short story is that he does escape. Then about a year and a half later came the novel, where the first chapter was the short story, and he somehow, successfully, and he was not writing with the fix-up in mind, fixed it up into a novel.
Yeah.
Well, I've had actually occasion to do things like that very recently.
Ah, okay.
What may seem like I designed a universe and threw it out there for Eric Flint and I to work in both co-equally. So I'm the collaborator in the 1632 novel universe, but we're co-owners of this one, and it's a steampunk, which I'm having.
And in some states, by the way, collaborating with Eric Flint can get you arrested.
Yeah. but there, I knew that the first...
And he should be proud of it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So at any rate... We're Ark Manor Press is doing a.
To double check, this collaboration you're doing with the good Senor Flint, it is part of my favorite alternate universe right now. 1632.
No, it is not. It is part of a steampunk universe called Steam Ether Empire, in which essentially we get to revisit a lot of historical issues and social issues very near and dear to Eric's heart at the turn of the fin de siècle. The date of the stories are 1902, 1904. Ether exists because the Maxwell, Maxwell turns out to be right, the quantum physicists turn out to be wrong.
What did you call it, the papal state?
That's 1635. That's a novel. That's the one that came out in October and was the Wall Street Journal bestseller. So that one is...
That's part of the 1632.
That's part of the 1632 universe. Absolutely right.
Now I want to say something to her majesty over here, the lovely Lady Silverman. You know, big things do come in small packages. Now, I don't mean to utter at all that your title, Time and Space, is a small package. But when I think of a title like that, which seems ordinary to the word, but to me, Hildy, it is a narrative wardrobe of the mind's eye. Let me tell you what I mean by that. When you walk through the wardrobe, and you're fighting the coat hangers, and all of a sudden you feel snow-covered branches on your face. your title opens up so many, a plethora of literary possibilities. Now, having said that, and you're probably going to destroy my Air Force in the hangar here.
Okay, well, we're actually at the time to start wrapping up the program. What we have not done is told listeners how to find each of you virtually, and also, again, to repeat the titles that you're currently plugging, pushing, whatever. So, first of all, on the magazine level, it's spaceandtimemagazine.com?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And spelled out A-N-D, so spaceandtimemagazine.com.
Yes, it's, I have problems with people. Some wise person at WBAI decided to come up, and listeners should try this out, but decided to come up with give2wbai.org. Lovely idea, except they made it the number two.
Oh.
So how do you say that on the air? Give number two.
Are you going to get bags of crack?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I think that's true.
Exactly. And so you're saying on the air this kind of a thing, and it's just, like, you know, let's get T.O. and do a redirect. And I can also imagine that you're saying give numeral to WBAI, and people are going to their computers and writing GIVNUMERALTWO. You know, it's like, oh, please. So, yes, it's space and time, all letters.
Yes, spaceandtimemagazine.com.
Okay, and is that also as far where you want to send people to find your work online? Do you have a separate page for
Hildy
the Writer?
Hildy the Writer has one of those Amazon pages up, but honestly, I've been very remiss in not putting up an author's page, which is very bad of me, and I should do that. You can find a lot of my work via Padwolf Press, Dark Quest Books, and Bayon's Anthologies, which is under their Techno Books. At the latest of which, vlog here. Padwolf Publishing put out both Mermaids 13 and Apocalypse 13, so those are the two latest, and you can find them. I believe they are padwolf.com. Yes, www.padwolf.com.
Yeah, I always drop the W's.
Yes.
And if you try it, you'll find, hey, guess what? It works.
Yes. As
long as they have a particular thing with their ISP, there's no reason to type in www.
Right.
It's just, you know.
And I should mention that Space and Time also has a Facebook page that feeds out to a Twitter account, so you can follow us there as well.
Okay, very good. Chuck, online.
Really hard to find, www.charlesegannon.com. Or, if you can't remember that, www.chuckgannon.com.
Okay, and Gannon with two N's.
Two N's. GANNON.
Okay, very good.
No number twos.
Because people do need it. Help the spelling helps. On
absolutely.
The radio, I've discovered.
Absolutely.
They're not always looking at their radios or giving out Earls.
Right.
Okay. closing thoughts, remarks. Any more questions? Any more phone calls coming in? No. So I should tell listeners that I am at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and also available on Facebook under Hour of the Wolf, as well as the nearest of readings. Another phone call coming in.
Yeah, I just have a question for Hildy. So, Hildy, is it also true that Space and Time magazine is available at Barnes & Noble nationwide?
Yes, it is. We are still carried through Barnes & Noble. Hopefully they'll last for a while.
You're supposed to say, I am so glad you asked that question, husband David.
I mean, unknown caller who I don't know at all.
So what would happen if, like, somebody would go into a Barnes & Noble and Space and Time magazine isn't there?
Well, then they should go up to the counter and say, I am looking for Space and Time magazine. Where is that? And they will hopefully call their home office and get that in for you.
I understand that you, David, are going to be in half of that magazine. The Time part, Time magazine.
I'll be in it. You will. That's
so it's only half as good as being in Space and Time.
Yeah, it's Space
when you're
and time
featured
so
in Time
much
magazine.
Time.
Yeah, I'm a New Yorker, but you've been in it.
Right.
So, and for those people who want to know what we're talking about, go to your nearest search engine and look up David Silverman and believe.
Not the Simpsons one.
Not the Simpsons and not the archaeologist.
Yeah.
The Simpsons? Was
David Silverman's a writer.
Okay.
And they do know each other, yes.
Oh, yeah. They should have a David Silverman con. That would be a great idea.
That would be fun.
Actually, that's got legs. Okay, well, thank you both for being here. We're going to have to do a separate interview at some point with Bill over there and with David. I've been trying to get you on the air, but you don't want to talk about genre fiction as much. You want
I want to talk about biblical fiction.
Biblical fiction, exactly. Yes. And so we're going to, the Begat episode of Hour of the Wolf, as it were. What begat biblical thinking, which is
where's Matthew Harrison Brady when you
need him? He and David would have a fascinating conversation. But at any rate, thank you for being here, and our audience of, I guess we have had 7 people in the room all told in and out, but thanks to the little recording device that we've got, there are thousands of people in this room at this moment. Excellent. So
thank you very much, Jim.
Yeah,
it was a great pleasure.
Thank you, Jim. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you. And you have been listening to an interview with Charles E. Gannon and Hilde Silverman, recorded live, which seemed like an oxymoron, last Saturday, March 16th, at the Lunacon Science Fiction Convention in Rybrook, New York. It was a fun experiment. I think in a few ways it worked rather well. And we'll see if we'll do other things like that maybe one of these years if we survive sometime in the far-flung, frightening future. As they like to say in science fiction, we'll do a live program in front of an audience somewhere else. But this was ours for the moment. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City at 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. And we are drawing to a close for the moment. Next week on this program, our guest will be Daniel Jose Older, and the week after that, Richard Bowes, and the week after that, Catherine Lundoff. Go to the website. You can just go to WBAI.org and find where you can give a donation. And then in the upper left corner, choose Give in the Name of Your Favorite Program, an e-donation in the name of your favorite program, and donate in the name of Hour of the Wolf to let them know what it is that has, well, compelled you this particular morning. You can also just give straight to the Transmitter Fund. So thank you all for listening, and we'll be back next week with Daniel Jose Older. Take care. Good morning.
it on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. No, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover.
I'm
99 single list alive right here at 516-620-3602 is the number. Emergency fundraising time right here. Make it 7 minutes after 3 o'clock. Burn, baby, burn the show. You know what we do best right here. You know what I mean? This is what we do best right here. Just got in from a place called Fort Myers. And a little place called Naples in Florida. You know what I mean? Yes, I. 99 single list alive, back on the radio where it belongs. To keep this militant canary alive, you know what to do. Go online at wbai.rg. Click, click. Make it a $500 pledge right now. In Shibuya Station, Nippon. Hey, 516-620-3602. Keep WBAI alive. Aya. Rubber dub. Aya. Man called Ahmed Ali from WSB sat in for me last week. Thanks very much. I owe you 52 burning slips, y'all. After 3 o'clock, we'll do this until 5 o'clock. Free speech radio news kicks in. Al Jazeera English kicks in. Esther kicks in at 6 o'clock. Punto Enseguida. 8 o'clock, Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Democracy Now More Than Ever. Robert Dove, y'all. Robert Knight on the case. The 5 o'clock shadow. In a place called Fort Myers, I heard some political clown in Crown Heights, not Crown Heights, Flatbush area. The dude who got stopped and frisked on Eastern Parkway, you know? Police, the pigs, shook him down, and he has the nerve to tell people that they should steer to the steer out of the community when it comes to stop and frisking, fighting for the 16-year-old youth's life who was shot down in Brooklyn, you know, mercilessly by the pigs. Now, this is foolishness. In a time when the world is just the size of a pinhead, how can a political opportunist get on the side of the pigs by saying, yo, steal to the community when we're demonstrating? That makes absolutely no sense. Pigs will be pigs. Remember that. They're defenders of the state. Pigs will be pigs. Pigs will be pigs. Defenders of the state. Flatbush Avenue, 55th Street. We know that. When it goes down, everybody is involved. No one is allowed to not be involved, y'all. Listen to this.
Cause they will rob from their own neighbors, so get them belly full. Then we kill you for your paper, so get them belly full. Then we turn you in a vapor, so get them belly full. I said, oh, good God of grace, please don't let them pass my way. When they're out there on their chases, just pray you're not around. Innocent are dead from strangers, so pray you're not around. Better you try to see me crazy.